This episode of The Sweaty Penguin is brought to you by Mini M&M's. Do you love to reminisce on the feeling of eating a handful of pebbles as a child? Try Mini M&M's today.
Between record-high ocean temperatures, mass coral bleaching, and hurricanes Idalia and Lee joining the list of brutal Atlantic hurricanes, there's plenty of reason to be concerned about the state of our oceans. Heck, I even saw a Florida man with one of those plastic rings stuck around his neck. It's getting bad out there. Wait, you're saying he was wearing the ring by choice? Yeah, that checks out. Unfortunately, some news outlets took those ocean concerns way too far. A headline was going around recently saying that the Gulf Stream could collapse as soon as 2025, and as much as that would be a great plot for the next apocalypse movie, that headline could not be further from the truth. Good Wednesday morning, I'm Ethan Brown, and this is Tip of the Iceberg, where I will break down some environmental news and then answer a question from our listeners on the air. Submit questions via Patreon, email, or social media. Patron questions go to the front of the line, so sign up at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. As I mentioned in our last episode, we just lost our main source of funding and we're in a bit of a struggle, so now more than ever, every patron will go such a long way. Please check out our offerings over there and consider joining. Since our Hurricane Hillary episode, we've had a few more major hurricanes. On August 30th, Hurricane Idalia made landfall in Florida before hitting Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and more. Idalia hit 130-mile-per-hour winds, displaced over 10,000 people, and led to 4 known casualties. It also spawned tornado outbreaks and rip currents that caused damage and looks to have recorded the highest storm surge in the history of Florida's Big Bend region. Little sidebar, we've talked about this before, but the National Hurricane Center has 6 lists of names for hurricanes, and we cycle through the lists, and each year we have first Hurricane A, second Hurricane B, and so on. But this creates a problem because some hurricanes end up being so famous that we can't use the name again. It would be like a teenage singer coming up named Kesha. Like, sorry, name's taken. So if a hurricane is really bad, we retire the name and replace it with a different one for next time. And that would be great, except we've had to retire 96 different names, and 13 of them, more than any other letter by a mile, start with the letter I. If Idalia is retired, which looks likely, it would be the 14th. And I don't know if you know 14 names that start with the letter I, but the scientists are struggling. I mean, look at these names we've had recently. Idalia? Ian? Isaias? Ivan? Ike? These are not storms, these are catfish on Tinder. I mean, what's left? Hurricane Irving? Who's gonna evacuate for that? I guess we're actually going to live out the famous quote from Alexander Hamilton, "In the eye of a hurricane, there is quiet." And then there's Hurricane Lee, which formed on September 5th and is still alive 2 weeks later. Lee's max wind speed hit 180 miles per hour, which was not far off from the all-time top 5 list for Atlantic hurricanes. And again, what are we doing with the names? I mean, if this thing is that bad, let's at least get a name with some syllables, or like a single hard consonant. Lee did most of its damage in eastern New England and some of the eastern Canadian provinces, and as of Saturday, 2 casualties had been reported, one in Maine and one in Florida. As always, we don't know the precise links between an individual hurricane and climate change until the scientists figure it out or TMZ catches them wearing the same friendship bracelet. Looking at you, Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce. Please be real, I really need this to be true right now. What we do know is that the North Atlantic Ocean has been smashing temperature records this year, hitting 24.9 degrees Celsius or 76.8 degrees Fahrenheit at the end of July. That's awesome when you're having trouble choosing between a beach day and hot tub, but not ideal for marine life. In fact, there was actually an unprecedented mass coral bleaching event and die-off from extreme water temperatures that spread across reefs in the Florida Keys at the end of July, leading to an urgent rescue operation to remove genetically important species from the ocean and transfer them to the Florida Institute of Oceanography's Keys Marine Laboratory and other controlled facilities. And as much as I love the idea of a coral reef rescue adoption with complimentary bumper stickers that say, "Who saved who?" it's not a great situation, and hopefully goes to show the extremes to which these ocean temperatures have risen. Now, as we discussed in our last tip of the iceberg, heat is energy. Unless it comes from a heated blanket, in which case, heat sucks all your energy until you fall asleep with a bowl of popcorn on your lap. And because heat is energy, these hurricanes are intensifying so much more rapidly in this unusually warm water. In fact, Hurricane Lee went from 80 mile per hour winds to 160 mile per hour winds in a day and a half, just the seventh storm in recorded history to intensify that quickly. I mean, that's faster than a ninth grade boy accelerates when his girlfriend says her parents aren't home. With all this change in the ocean, I think it's understandable that some people might feel like this is a climate apocalypse. People often talk about the idea of climate tipping points, where certain climate systems get thrown so out of whack that they completely snowball, and even if we stop greenhouse gas emissions, it wouldn't even matter because the damage would be irreversible. It's like when you're a day late on a paper, and the professor says it's okay, just turn it in, but you decide that's not an option and you might as well flunk out of college and go to clown school. If anyone can recommend any clown schools to me, let me know. I think the climate clown is something the world needs. And yes, tipping points do exist. They're not like dominoes. If we hit one, that doesn't mean we hit all of them and humans cease to exist. We still want to mitigate climate change as much as possible and prevent as much damage as is feasible. But tipping points are concerning, and since we've been talking about oceans, I want to revisit a wonky story that went around a couple months ago on this. So this was toward the end of July. Several news outlets, including Smithsonian, New York Post, Live Science, and The Guardian, published stories with headlines saying the Gulf Stream could collapse as soon as 2025, sparking global climate chaos. And that would be really terrifying, but thankfully, the story was completely off base. The study they referenced from Nature found that the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, which if you couldn't tell is not the Gulf Stream, they found that AMOC could collapse sometime in the next century, with error bars spanning from 2025 to 2095. I say could because this was one study, not scientific consensus. In other words, these news outlets turned AMOC might collapse sometime this century to the Gulf Stream could collapse by 2025, which are two entirely different things. It's like when you tell your girlfriend she can't buy a 10th decorative pumpkin at Trader Joe's and she decides you don't love her anymore. Let's break all that down a little more. The Gulf Stream is part of a larger global ocean circulation that brings warm water from the Florida area up to near Newfoundland. This particular current is toward the surface of the ocean and carries a lot of water, varying from 30 to 150 million cubic meters per second. Kind of iconic that water is moving that fast just to get away from Florida. And that process is really important. In addition to ensuring that water never has to encounter an alligator, the Gulf Stream influences weather patterns, marine life migrations, navigation routes for ships, and brings warmer water up the east coast of the US, making New England beaches slightly less unbearable. I mean, you all know the limerick. There once was a stream in Nantucket. It brought water north by the bucket. It warmed up the shores, brought fish by the scores. If it didn't exist, we'd say, "Hey, you didn't let me finish." Now, what happens to the water from the Gulf Stream once it gets to Newfoundland and realizes its mistake? To be honest with you, this was a little confusing for me, and a lot of websites explain this very differently, but I've read some stuff from climate scientists, and I really hope I can explain this right. So as I understand it, as that warm water moves north, a few things can happen. As wind blows over it, some of the water can evaporate off. Once it gets really far north, it could freeze into sea ice, though I don't think we're quite far north enough for that in this particular example. But for either or both of these reasons, north-flowing water gets saltier. Almost as salty as Landon Barker's new song about Chase Hudson. Dude, leave him alone. When some of that north-flowing water turns into ice or vapor, it will leave the salt behind for the remaining water. And salt water is actually denser than fresh water. This means that the salty water will sink and ultimately link up with deeper ocean currents traveling south. So that happens, but there's another factor at play too. In a shocking twist for King Ferdinand II, Earth is a sphere, and it rotates from west to east. Now picture how that rotation looks on a globe. If you're standing on the equator, one day or one rotation of the Earth means you have to go a really long distance. But if you put your finger on, say, the Leaning Tower of Pisa and rotate your globe, that rotation is a much shorter distance, since it's closer to the top of the sphere. Just don't press down on it too hard, it's a little lopsided and it might fall down if you're not careful. Thankfully, some tourists are holding it up. And then if you put your finger on the North Pole and rotate the globe, your finger won't move at all. What all that means is people and stuff on the equator are actually moving through space faster than stuff up north and stuff down south. So let's say I'm a current of Atlantic Ocean water, I'm trying to escape Florida, so I'm moving north with the Gulf Stream. When I started down by Florida, I was moving really fast to the east because of the rotation of the Earth. I was moving faster than the water north of me. And that means as I go north into that slower moving water, my momentum will swing me eastward. I'll be trying to go north, but I'll overshoot and sort of go northeast. Let that go on long enough, and it ends up forming a new current, transporting about 10% of that warm Gulf Stream water into the Northeast Atlantic by the UK. That current is called the North Atlantic Drift, and that one is really significant. I mean, if we're ranking drifts, I'd say 1. North Atlantic Drift, 2. Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift, 3. Drift Away. We don't talk about this enough, but London is actually further north than Montreal, Calgary, Winnipeg, really the vast majority of Canada's population, and London is in the southern part of the UK. The reason it's habitable and not just overrun by moose is this ocean current, the North Atlantic Drift, that brings warm water up to the region. It regulates the temperature and allows people to comfortably live much further north than they do in much of North America. Well, comfort is subjective. I personally wouldn't consider a city that serves mushy peas to be fit for human life. But much like what happens over by Newfoundland, that North Atlantic drift water will also get salty, sink deep into the ocean, and head south. And that phenomenon is what kicks off the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. Title drop, right? Do I get a mic drop for that? Actually, I kind of hate that sound. Never mind. Because only 10% of the Gulf Stream water actually enters the North Atlantic Drift, though, That means AMOC is a much smaller current than the Gulf Stream. I know that was a lot, but if you take one thing from it, it is that the Gulf Stream and AMOC are two different things. As Executive Director of the California Academy of Sciences, Dr. Jonathan Foley put it, the Gulf Stream is a superhighway of warm water circulating around the North Atlantic. A small exit ramp called the North Atlantic Drift branches off, heading north, and this exit goes to a third smaller road where AMOC begins. I assume AMOC has a Best Western, a Cracker Barrel, and a Wawa for your convenience as well. To the headlines that I referenced earlier, the Gulf Stream is not collapsing, ever. As long as the Earth is spinning and wind is blowing, the Gulf Stream will be there. It's committed. It's not talking to other girls. It doesn't even have an Instagram. I mean, talk about trustworthy. AMOC, on the other hand, is getting hit by climate change. As I understand it, the issue is that AMOC starts near Greenland, and Greenland is a massive, fast-melting ice sheet. Like we discussed, AMOC is turbocharged by salty surface water sinking. But the ice from Greenland would be fresh water. That dilutes the salty water from the North Atlantic Drift, causing less water to sink, essentially slowing down the AMOC process. Will it actually collapse, though? We really don't know. You'd have to talk to its therapist. In the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's special report on the ocean and cryosphere, they essentially wrote, AMOC is very likely to weaken in the 21st century, no matter what our greenhouse emissions are, but a collapse is very unlikely, and they can say that with medium confidence. Based on projections from a project with the World Climate Research Program, they say there's about a 50-50 chance of an AMOC collapse by 2300 if we were not to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. At that point, Captain Kirk would be 67. And personally, I find that scenario unlikely, because we already are reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and there really wouldn't be any reason to reverse that. For context, IPCC reports are a synopsis of all the recent science that is out there at the time of writing, so they would have read many, many studies to come to these conclusions. However, there are some scientists that disagree with that, and I think we know what that means. It's time for Scientist WrestleMania! And of course, this latest paper in Nature, which is a peer-reviewed journal, now provides additional evidence that an AMOC collapse may be more imminent than that IPCC report said. This paper estimates an AMOC collapse in the 2050s if we were to not mitigate greenhouse gas emissions, which again, we are and I believe will continue to, and they put error bars from 2025 to 2095. In other words, they're confident it will be somewhere in that range. They think it will be closer to the middle, but it's possible it could be anywhere in there. It's like me looking for my sunglasses. I know it's in my apartment, I think it's by the front door, but where are they? I have no clue, and I guess I'll find out in 30 years. Now, I'm not a scientist. I'm just Ken. I have seen others say this was good research. Certainly it would have to be to get through the peer review process. When I tried to get my paper proving why dogs are better than cats that I wrote with a crayon on a napkin through the peer review process, they banned me from submitting to the journal ever again, so it must be a rigorous process. But it's still one paper. And the IPCC came up with something different when they reviewed at least dozens, probably hundreds of others. And that's how science works, right? Everyone agrees and has replicated the finding that AMOC is weakening and climate change is contributing and a collapse would be really bad. But not everyone agrees on the timescale yet. And so we press on. That's why they all still have jobs. We don't know everything yet. It doesn't negate what we do know. It doesn't mean go bully scientists on Twitter. It just means we have to keep working. And with that being the status of things, for all these media outlets to say the Gulf Stream could collapse by 2025 is absolutely absurd. I know it's flashier than ocean current you've never heard of might collapse this century, but we don't know enough to say that yet, and also we can probably prevent it just by accelerating all the good things we're already doing. But sometimes science doesn't fit the most clickbait headline. The facts of climate change that we know today are enough reason to be concerned and take steps to mitigate it. If the media piles onto that with misinformation, we do two things. One, we make people who are skeptical of climate change even more skeptical, especially when the Gulf Stream does not collapse in 2 years and they can say, see, they can't be trusted. Sadly, that sentiment reflects back onto the scientists, even though it was news outlets making the mistake. It's like a stranger stealing your phone and texting your crush the eggplant emoji. And two, we make people who are anxious about climate change a whole lot more anxious, and that's a slippery slope. As I discuss all the time, feelings of fear and anxiety can often lead us to disengage with an issue because we get too overwhelmed. That's why the facts of climate change need to be communicated sensitively. I choose to do that via humor, nuance, and lots of solutions talk. And that's also why doom and gloom misinformation is only detrimental. Especially in the wake of extreme hurricanes, it is so important to get people the right information. When there's uncertainty, we should not be transforming it into the most clickbait news story possible. Unless, of course, it's Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce's relationship. In my brain, they're already married with 3 kids, and you can't tell me otherwise. And now, here's Mo with the news.
Hey, this is Mo with the Sweaty Penguins Weekly Update. In August, the National Ignition Facility announced a new breakthrough in nuclear fusion technology. A nuclear fusion reaction essentially mimics the process of the sun. Put two hydrogen atoms together at an unfathomable temperature and pressure until they fuse into a single helium atom, releasing energy in the process. You know, a process very common at your mom's house. Last month, the National Ignition Facility scientists generated their second ever successful nuclear fusion reaction. And you know what they say? Fuse me once, shame on you. Fuse me twice, well, insert punchline here about me having sex with your mother. Contrails, the white streaks left behind by airplanes, not evidence left behind by scammers, and definitely better than brown streaks left in a pair of underwear, account for about 35% of aviation's global warming impact, as highlighted in the 2022 IPCC report. Which sucks, because they look cool as frick, especially when they skywrite, "Look at me, accounting for about 35% of aviation's global warming impact, as highlighted in the 2022 IPCC report." Google Research used AI in collaboration with American Airlines and Breakthrough Energy to generate contrail forecast maps to help pilots select routes that minimize contrail formation. In a test involving 70 flights, pilots reduced contrail creation by 54% using this AI-based system, despite the fact that I was on board and farting literally the entire time. I'm getting word that this was because I was leaving green streaks in the air, not white. So, sorry about that. I wasn't part of the calculations. Although these contrail-avoiding routes might have consumed 2% more fuel and have given every passenger the chance to finish the last 5 minutes of their show, avoiding contrails remains a cost-effective way to reduce climate impact at approximately 5 to 25 tons of CO2e. Research will continue to further develop and automate this approach to reduce the environmental impact of flying. A new study has looked at how climate change might affect the financial health of countries. Which already makes sense to me. I mean, climate change definitely affects my bank account. Too hot? Buy ice cream. Too cold? Hot cocoa. It's snowing? Screw that, I'd rather buy a casket. You know, I'd rather die. The study suggests that if we don't do something to reduce carbon emissions, 55 countries could end up having to pay way more money to cover their debts in the next 10 years because the country's credit ratings could go down. Maybe they could try Credit Karma. Not sponsored. The study used AI to mix up credit ratings with computer models that predict how climate change can mess up economies. They got the data from a company called S&P Global, which stands for Standard & Poor's Global, not Sippin' and Pissin', which would be a great tagline for a hard seltzer. They found that these credit rating downgrades could be even worse than what we saw when COVID-19 hit. And you know something's bad if it's worse than the COVID-19. I mean, the only thing worse than the COVID-19 pandemic are this, the Game of Thrones finale, and trying to turn left at an intersection without a green arrow. You're gonna make me turn left on Olympic at my own will without an arrow? Now that's dangerous. Researchers have utilized AI-controlled cameras and microphones to detect and monitor animals and birds in the wild, aiming to address the UK's biodiversity challenges. That's right, due to the strike in Hollywood still seeming to have no end, we're officially outsourcing and leaving it up to the wildlife to make the next big mockumentary television series. These robotic monitors successfully identified various species using AI with no human intervention. Dozens of different birds like the Eurasian blackcap, blackbird, and great tit were recognized from their songs. Not that AI cares, but I also can recognize a great tit when I see one. Foxes, deer, and bats, oh my, were also pinpointed and identified by AI analysis. It also revealed that animals like hedgehogs often use railway lines, leading to ideas like hedgehog highways in Scotland to protect them. Almost like a hamster tube city. Or, and as a fan of Disney's Zootopia, I'm hoping there's a Judy Hopps-inspired police force in our future. Judy Hopps, call me. The primary goal is to demonstrate that AI technology can effectively survey wildlife, informing conservation strategies in the face of climate change. Who knows, maybe Judy Hopps' AI-generated ASMR roleplay might be intimate too. I can only hope. Maybe Nick Wilde can get involved. This has been Mo with the Sweaty Penguin in this week's weekly update.
Fear your teeth may fall out at any moment due to the tiny sugar balls that Skittles are? Then mini M&Ms are for you. With mini M&Ms, you can avoid the sweet rainbow taste of Skittles while supporting cocoa deforestation in West Africa. What's more, mini M&Ms aren't just food, but a musical instrument. You've tried turning Twizzlers into guitar strings and replacing all the keys on your piano with Kit Kats, but the only candy possible of giving you the sweet, sweet sound of music is the mini M&Ms in their container tube. Mini M&Ms, keeping you on tempo.
Welcome back to Tip of the Iceberg. It's time for Ask Me Anything, where our listeners get a chance to ask me any environmental questions they may have. Submit questions on our Patreon, email, or social media. Patron questions go to the front of the line, so be sure to sign up today at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. Today's Ask Me Anything, I got this similar question. I don't know if it's a question or a comment from a few people. So BigSmooth418 said, the next step is just tell China and India to stop polluting because they are the main polluters. This will go over well. Joseph Schimandel says, tell them that China, the number one polluter, just pulled out of the recent Paris Climate Accord, so nothing the rest of the world can do will offset their growing output. You're beating a dead horse, not to mention the developing second and third world countries are buying more oil, building more coal-fired electric power plants, and driving more polluting cars, never going EV. So I get this question a lot, even though those were more comments, but kind of the question about what the U.S.'s role is when climate change action largely relies on other countries pulling their weight as well. And I think that there's a few things to this. So first off, the idea that China and India in, I'll start with those countries, that they in particular don't care about this is not accurate. China did not pull out of the Paris Accord. There have been negotiations that have broken down with them as a challenging partner. There have been talks that China wants to go at climate change alone rather than working with the rest of the world. But China is, for all the issues this brings, they are leading the world in clean energy manufacturing. They are where a lot of the polysilicon gets developed for solar panels. And that's an issue we've talked about before, because some of that happens in forced labor camps with Uyghur Muslims. So I'd encourage you to check out our solar power episode to learn more about that issue. But there's a lot going on in China, and they've even said globally that they intend to become carbon neutral by 2060. Are their emissions growing? Yes. Are they sort of flattening a little bit so that they will peak in the next decade? Yes, they are, and they should be trending in the right direction in the next 10 years, if not sooner. As for India, India came to COP27 last year in Egypt, and they proposed a phase down of all fossil fuels as part of the agreement. And a lot of the world supported this. A lot of island countries, the European Union, even the United States, supported unabated fossil fuels, aka fossil fuels without some mechanism to capture and store the carbon it emits. But that was India taking that leadership. And that was something I had talked about since the beginning of Tip of the Iceberg. Episode 2 of Tip of the Iceberg was about this. So that happened. And I think that when we say these countries don't care and we can't work with them, it's not true. There is a lot of room to work together. Certainly there are differences, there are issues. It's challenging when you both have the same goal, but also have some differing goals geopolitically, but it is entirely possible. Are there countries that are a lot more difficult to work with on this? Absolutely. That's a big challenge. But in terms of bringing more and more people on board, what you have to do, in my view, is take the steps at home to mitigate emissions and show why taking those steps is beneficial. Look at it this way. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in their latest report, put together a table where they compared, I believe it was 43 different climate solutions with the 17 sustainable development goals, things like end world hunger, end poverty, innovation, gender equality, all things that we would love to see in our society. And they looked to see if each climate solution paired with one of those goals, if there were synergies, if there were trade-offs, or if there was a combination. And they found that a majority had synergies, and only 12 out of hundreds had trade-offs, all trade-offs. So furthermore, they also looked just at cost and saw that many of these solutions actually save money. The ones that do cost money cost a lot less than the cost of cleaning up the climate disasters that would ensue if we didn't do it. So put all that together, and we're really looking at a situation where these solutions are not just climate solutions. They help a lot of other stuff. And if we do them and other countries don't do them, sure, we might not mitigate climate change to the extent that we would like, but we will end up ahead because we did them and because these are just good ideas regardless. So that's where I kind of look at this and say, we shouldn't use other countries as an excuse to not do these things. If anything, other countries not doing it should motivate us. I don't want to say motivate us more, because but if you're of the mindset that the USA should be on top of the world and be the leader and win economically and what have you, which I'm sure many in the U.S. are, then this stuff is a good idea for that too. And if you're of the mindset that we all need to work together on climate and hopefully we can bring all these other countries on board and they can do these things as well, then again, doing it here is the first step to that. We have to do it, show why it works, and then let other countries follow. One thing I'll add, the reason I wanted to bring this up again is this actually came up in the Republican primary debate, and I think it was very very cool to see climate be the second topic discussed. I actually am connected through various channels to, I probably know someone who knows someone who knows the guy that asked the audience question about climate. So I thought it was very cool that that person received that opportunity. And I think I'll leave it to you to decide what to make of that discussion. But I thought that the fact that that discussion happened, or at least was brought up, was very, very cool. And I hope it can lead to more of those conversations on the national stage. I think it's always a big part of my goal to show that there are ideas for how to address climate change that may align with more left values and more right values and anything in between. And so I hope that those ideas can be discussed more on the national stage. It won't just seem like an issue for one party or the other. And from there, we can make progress. There already has been a decent amount of bipartisan climate action in the U.S., but we don't talk about it enough, and it's certainly not on the quite the large scale that we would love to see it. So there's my thoughts on that. Thank you so much for the comments and the questions, as always. And thanks to everyone who listened to Tip of the Iceberg. Take 2 minutes, help out the show, and get a shout out at the end of the show by leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple or Podcast Addict. Or join our Patreon at patreon.com/thesweatypenguin. Again, so, so important right now. So we really, really hope you'll check that out. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you on Friday for a deep dive on the North Dome gas field. This is one of the largest gas fields in the world. It is in Qatar. It was a big part of what funded the FIFA World Cup, among other things, in Qatar. So very interesting, very relevant. I will see you then. Thank you.